Coming up, I got 10 thoughts from a busy weekend in the NBA on the rumor mill starting to heat up. The NBA draft, including what I think is a serious oversight in their lottery reform proposal that's being voted on this Thursday, as well as, of course, the NBA conference finals. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. I got 10 thoughts from a busy weekend in the NBA with the conference finals happening, the NBA draft up around the corner. Rumor mill is heating up as well. So let's get into it, starting with the Spurs and the Thunder. San Antonio won game four, 103-82 to tie it up, 2-2. And number one thought, San Antonio changed up their coverage against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. This was the key to this victory. We saw in games one, two, and three, the Spurs sending two pretty frequently against SGA when he got a touch outside the three-point line. This was to try to force the ball out of his hands, prevent him from penetrating, but that didn't work. It led to a lot of open kitchen shoots, lobs for the Oklahoma City Thunder, and it was different in game four. They played him more one-on-one. They weren't sending two as hard. Sometimes they would late, but it worked to great effect in forcing him just to take some really tough, heavily contested pull-up jumpers, and sometimes, you know, Victor would even help over and get a hand on it. But this was the key for San Antonio in this game four and what is looking like a series of adjustments, because if you look at game one, game two, and game three combined of the catch-and-shoot three-point jumpers that Oklahoma City got, 75% of those were labeled as unguarded threes, according to Synergy Sports. So that means three-fourths of their catch-and-shoot threes were unguarded. In game four, that dropped to 44%. 14 of their three-pointers were guarded. 11 were unguarded. And that is as a result of the adjustment the Spurs made to their defense. Now, San Antonio was able to do this in part because no Jalen Williams, he's out with the hamstring, and no A.J. Mitchell, he's out with the calf strain. And so Oklahoma City, they got SGA. They don't have their second ball handler. They don't have their third ball handler. They're down to Jared McCain, Chet Holmgren. I mean, these other guys on this team that aren't up to snuff to handle that responsibility next to SGA. And this was really the story of those Spurs-Thunder games over the course of the regular season, too. In the games A.J. Mitchell played, Oklahoma City had a really hard time generating quality shot opportunities. In the game that he did play, they looked a lot better. Very similar results so far in the in this series so far. And I think for SGA, games one, two, and three, he generated 1.25 points per drive. And that's in part because of the defense San Antonio is playing. In game four, that fell to 0.94. A dramatic drop for SGA, in part because of him getting forced outside, him not able to get open three-point opportunities for his teammates, and the lack of secondary creators to get even him downhill more often. And I posted on X during the game, without Jalen Williams and A.J. Mitchell, who's generating offense? Chet's not capable. McCain's streaky. Wallace, Dort, and Caruso, they're all role players. Nikola Topic time? Only half kidding. And, you know, I posted that thinking there'd be a little bit of a, you're an idiot for even suggesting this. But OKC fans were actually like, I mean, maybe. And I don't think it's going to happen. But I do look back to last year in the postseason. A.J. Mitchell, when he was a rookie, largely played garbage time. But there were a few stints he got playing for 2 or 3 minutes in big games for the Thunder. Like competitive games, not blowouts, in the conference finals and the NBA finals. And look, Topic would have been probably a top five pick if he didn't suffer the torn ACL that knocked him out for his whole rookie season. Probably would have been top five. He averaged 18 points per game, shot 47% from three, and at 8 assists per game with very low turnovers in the G League. It's just the G League. Everybody's good in the G League, even Killian Hayes. So I'm not overreacting to it. But I'm just saying, if you need a little ball handling and creation, maybe that's a solution for Mark Daigneault to at least try for a 2-minute stretch just to see what happens if they're going to be without Jalen Williams, which it seems like they will be without him, and then possibly without A.J. Mitchell. We don't know his status yet for game five with that calf strain. So number two thought here, this relates to Victor Wembanyama and SGA. How SGA's shot selection is changing in this series. And it the numbers are just staggering to look at for the whole postseason. And this perfectly lines up with what he did during the regular season. He took 24% of his shots at the rim, 17% of his shots in the paint non-restricted area, 38% of his shots from mid-range, 21% of his shots from three-point range. Okay, so that's his whole playoff numbers, right? Then against the Spurs, with Wemby on the floor, his at-rim rate drops to 12 from 24. His non-rim paint attempts drops from 17 to 10. Mid-range goes up from 38% to 57%, and his three-point rate stays exactly the same at 21%. So Wemby's presence alone is deterring SGA from getting into the paint at all. He's just not touching the paint. When Wemby's off the floor in the Spurs series, it's crazy. He goes up to 67% of his shots come in the paint. So when Cornette's out there, SGA is trying to make up for lost time. But this really is indicative of the entire series right now. Wemby is turning SGA into a completely different type of player. He's basically turning him into DeMar DeRozan. You're not getting to the rim. You're taking mid-range pull-up after mid-range pull-up. That's what he's turned him into in this series. In the minutes where Wemby and SGA have both been on the floor, SGA is a minus 14 in game one, a plus 5 in game two, a minus 4 in game three, and then in game four, a minus 24. So in the minutes Wemby and SGA are both are on the floor, SGA is a minus 37. Wemby is a plus 37 in the series. The dude is averaging nearly 30, 10 on 50, 40, 90 in the postseason against OKC in the Western Conference Finals right now. He didn't have a good game three. I thought he didn't bring intensity. He had 4 rebounds in the game. I thought game four, he was absolutely sensational. And you see the ripple effect here with no AJ Mitchell, no Jalen Williams on SGA, but it also happens with Chet Holmgren as well. Chet Holmgren, he was named to an All-NBA team the other day. Look, I had him on my team. It's in part because he's so sensational defensively and he's a great finisher, but the dude can't create. Sometimes it just looks like he's scared to me of Victor Wembanyama. When you see him put the ball on the floor and try to create throughout this series, anytime Wemby's around, he's like, no, I'm not even going to challenge, even though I'm 6 foot tall. And these numbers pop up with the shot distribution numbers as well. He dribbles and these numbers with Chet Holmgren are also very clear with his shot distribution habits. He's taken 24 shots so far this series when Wemby's on the floor. Only 6 of them, he's dribbled the ball at least once. He's been a finisher, catch and shoot, lobs, putbacks. And that's it. You can't rely on Chet Holmgren to put the ball on the floor. And this has long been one of my, concerns, I guess you could call it, with Chet. I don't want to necessarily expect what he's not. But at Gonzaga, the reason why I had Chet ranked 3rd that year, and that was a mistake. I probably should have had him ranked 1st ahead of Paolo Banchero and ahead of Jabari Smith. But the reason why I had him ranked 3rd is because I didn't see the creation upside with him in the ways that others did. It didn't matter for OKC, right? Like when OKC's healthy, Chet's a finisher. But for a guy who's getting paid a max contract, who's an all-NBA player, you would hope he doesn't look so fearful when he has to create off the dribble. And we're seeing that in this series where he can't just settle for taking catch and shoot threes, can't just settle for crashing the offensive boards. They need Chet the creator, but he's incapable of doing that. And so he's now being put in a responsibility with his role to do more than he's able to. And that speaks to his limitations as a player. And if OKC doesn't get J-Dub back and they don't get AJ Mitchell back in this series, I don't like the way this is trending for the Oklahoma City Thunder, because I don't think you can expect Chet Holmgren to step up there. Number 5, Victor Wembanyama. I thought when he hit that half-court shot at the end of the second quarter, that's when I knew they were going to win this game. There was no chance that Oklahoma City was going to come back in the second half. That was just a miraculous moment, very cool moment for Wemby to call for the ball and then hit the half-court shot. He also had some cool moments in this game where you're starting to see him do some crazy stuff where they're just throwing the ball up to him. It happened in the second half of the game where he got thrown a lob and then he kind of tapped it off the glass and then tapped it back in. He's done this a bit throughout the series where if he's kind of in an awkward spot on drives, he's just hoisting it up at the backboard, knowing that he can be the guy to grab the offensive board. And he's getting those putback opportunities. And with Wemby, it reminded me of something he did pre-draft when he was still with Mets 92. The time he took a step back three-pointer and he grabbed his own offensive rebound for a putback dunk. I was just thinking about that last night while watching him do it once again, do what he did inside the paint. Can you imagine the reaction if he does this in the conference finals or possibly even the NBA finals, step back three, rebounding his own miss? It's just crazy, crazy to imagine Victor actually doing that in the NBA, not just internationally. But dude, like, I think he's figuring out some of these little quirks, these things he's capable of doing to compensate for the fact he quite frankly still is, you know, underdeveloped with go-to moves. He doesn't necessarily have his trademark shot yet, but maybe the trademark shot for Victor Wembanyama is the ability just to do something that nobody else can do. And we saw him do that once again in game four with that throw it up, knowing I'm going to grab my own miss and put it back. Number six, of course, this is not just a Wemby team, right? Like, I think sometimes when you watch the Spurs, it's all about Victor, and understandably so. I think he is the best player in the world. I think he should have been the MVP, but he's got a really good team around him. And you got to give credit to Stephon Castle for settling down this series. He had 20 turnovers through the first two games. He has two turnovers since then. And that's in part because Fox is back. But also, I do feel like Castle has slowed down a bit and is making better decisions out there on the floor. It's very much unlike Cade Cunningham, who continued to be sped up throughout the entire postseason and far too casual with the ball in his hands. Castle, I think he has done a good job of adapting to this defensive pressure that you're seeing from the Thunder within this series alone. Never mind the fact he's playing great defense individually on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but so is Devin Vassell. I mean, this guy, he has always been, for a long time since the pre-Wemby era, a very good basketball player. And he has become a great basketball role player for the Spurs team. He's the unsung hero of the team. He's 7 of 13 on pull-up jumpers in the series, shooting 38% on catch-and-shoot threes, defending Jalen Williams prior to his injury, defending Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, defending off-ball as a helper as well. He's long. He's active. We saw the big block he had earlier in the series as well. Mitch Johnson, the Spurs head coach, talked about him after the game and how kind of like overlooked he is, but how he's so steady and so consistent. And that undoubtedly is the truth with Vassell on both ends of the floor. This guy constantly brings it and constantly makes a positive impact. And those are the types of supporting players you need next to your stars to get to an NBA Finals and to win an NBA Finals. And if the Spurs are going to win this series, which I think they're gonna, you're going to need Vassell to continue on. But I say that because I don't like the way this series is trending for SGA. The shot distribution numbers, the fact he doesn't have J-Dub and there's no return in sight for him, the fact AJ Mitchell's dealing with the calf injury, this feels like another story that we've seen play out many times before. A team trying to go back-to-back, just fizzling out deep into the postseason because of injuries and fatigue, just all adding up. It's hard to do what LeBron did for a decade and go to the finals every single year and stay healthy. And that might be indeed what's happening here with the Oklahoma City Thunder. But hey, we're setting up for a game five on Tuesday night where SGA is going to have a banger performance. SGA is going to have one of those games where he forces the Spurs to double because he cannot be stopped pulling up from outside. He can't be stopped from pulling up from three-point range, and I can't wait to see how it plays out, but I don't like the way it's trending for the Thunder at all in this series, even after the wins.
We'll be right back.
Let's talk about the Knicks and the Cavaliers and some other stuff going on around the NBA before my interview later on with Kingston Fleming's potential top 10 pick in the NBA draft. Number seven, the Knicks are one win away from an NBA Finals. Any Knicks fan listening to this, I'm happy for you. You're in this spot. I mean, look, it's been a long time coming. I know what it's like growing up a fan of a team where you hear stories, especially if you're younger listening to this, stories from your dad or your mom or your big brother, whoever, about, oh, I badly want to see a Knicks team in the finals in my lifetime. I don't think it's ever going to happen. Well, one win away, and it could happen tonight. I think it will happen tonight against this pathetic Cavaliers team that has given up on themselves in the middle of the fourth quarter in game one and gave up again in game three. Just pathetic effort from this Cavaliers team. More on them in a second. But with the Knicks, I was thinking over the weekend, because I wrote a story on Yahoo Sports earlier in the month in May about the lottery reform coming up. And we'll talk about that in a second too. But with lottery reform, one of the pushbacks of it has been, well, how are you supposed to build a winning team, a contending team, if you don't have the ability to be bad and get top picks? And that's been one of the major pushbacks against it. And I think you can look around the league at a bunch of different teams at how they've built their rosters. And everybody does it differently. Some people, like the Spurs, it's come from top picks. And some teams, like the Knicks, it's come from masterful trades. That's how the Knicks have built this team. They became the potential representative of the Eastern Conference through smart trades and decisions by the front office. They got the third pick back in 2019. I was in the lottery room that year, the Zion Williamson year. The Knicks got the third pick. They drafted RJ Barrett that year. So they did have a top pick. But RJ Barrett is fine. He's not a franchise changer. And they made a smart decision to trade RJ Barrett with Emmanuel Quickley to go get OG Anunoby from the Toronto Raptors. They got Jalen Brunson, a guy who, you know, he put up big numbers in Dallas with his opportunities, but he wasn't proven as a max level player. They went out and got him and said, he's our guy anyway. That was a shrewd decision to do that. Not something every organization would have done either, even though there's the connection with his father as well. And that definitely had something to do with him. But they took risks. That was a risk for Brunson to have a small guard as your best player. They took another big one, trading Julius Randle for Karl Anthony Towns. They bet on Towns as a guy who could raise the ceiling of that team as well as the floor based off of what he did in Minnesota. He's done exactly that on this run to the finals for the Knicks. They made a very aggressive trade for Josh Hart. They gave up a first-round pick to Portland to go get Hart, despite the fact, can he shoot? Is he actually a playoff player? Yes, he's a playoff player. He embodies what it takes to win. They traded a lot for Mikal Bridges. They took a risk in doing that. And we're seeing Bridges turn his year around in the last 10 games or so. He's been unbelievable. This is the Bridges they hope to get. They hope for this guy to perform in the postseason. 82 games are great, but they wanted it during the playoffs. They hired and fired coaches. It wasn't a no-brainer to get rid of Tibbs. They did it anyway, and Mike Brown is very clearly an upgrade over Tom Thibodeau. With his adaptability this postseason, that was a home run decision for the Knicks 1 year ago to fire Tibbs and bring in Brown. And they made moves around the edges, right? These margin moves. They drafted Mitchell Robinson and Deuce McBride, both with the 36th pick. Of course, Robinson was in the prior regime. But you get my point with these guys they've kept around to support the stars. Getting Jose Alvarado earlier this year, adding Landry Shamet, who's been kind of a journeyman. All of these moves have been put together to construct a deep, talented team that is going to the NBA Finals. And they didn't do it with the draft. They did it with smart signings and smart trades. And so the Knicks, some of these decisions also have nothing to do with them being a big market team. Nothing. These are just smart front office moves. And so when it comes to lottery reform and the randomness that's going to come from the lottery in the years to come, I think there's going to be a talent gap that widens between the great front offices like the Knicks and the poor front offices. And ownerships are going to have to be very, very proactive in figuring out whether their front offices have any idea what they're doing when it comes to building a team, or if they're just the type of front office that's just hoping to get lucky and win the lottery. Number eight, the Cleveland Cavaliers. Their season is over. It's done. I think this whole era might actually be over anyway. Did you see Donovan Mitchell after game three? He's kind of looked super relaxed, like there was a sense of acceptance. We're not winning this series. We're not winning it. And I felt bad for him. Oh, kind of. I sort of felt bad for him when he made the comment about how Knicks fans showed up in Cleveland in game three and were chanting and going crazy. And he's like, I grew up a Knicks fan. I know they do that. He's like, but Cavaliers fans are the best fans in the world. We just didn't give them something to root for. It's like in the back of his mind, he's definitely thinking, what could have been? What could have been if I had been traded to the Knicks like I had wanted? Maybe I could have been in Jalen Brunson's spot. I'm not sure the Knicks would be here if they had Donovan Mitchell instead of Jalen Brunson, though. Brunson is just the far better player, the far better shooter, the far better creator. And we're seeing that gap in this series between those two, between Brunson and Mitchell. And that's no shot at Mitchell. He's a very good player in his own right. I've been a big fan of his game for a long time since he was a prospect out of Louisville. I love what he's become. But he's just not the number one. And ultimately, the Cavs have a bunch of number twos and number threes and number fours like Evan Mobley and James Harden and Jared Allen. They don't have enough. This is not a perfectly constructed team. Kenny Atkinson, the head coach, had at last year when they lost to the Pacers, he said something along the lines, I've brought it up 100 times by now, we don't play with enough force and intensity like the Pacers. We need to have better stamina. I bet you he's going to say the same thing after this series is over against the Knicks. The Knicks play with more force and intensity, and they have better stamina. They have more heart. The Cavaliers have none of it. And that's the difference between these teams. And Kenny Atkinson, let's go to a clip of him talking between games three and four, because this clip to me, I don't even know if he fully believes what he's saying, but here's Kenny Atkinson.
Analytically, I think we won the expect. I said 3 out of 3. We're 2 out of 3, and the expected. I don't know if you guys follow that. It's an expected score. If you believe in process and all that, I know no one wants to hear that. I think you guys like hearing it. I know, you know, general public, no one wants to hear that. Everyone's outcome.
Yeah, Kenny, what are you doing? You're down 3-0. You blew a massive lead in game one. You pooped your pants in game three at home, and you're probably going to lose tonight in game four. You're down 3-0. You can't be talking about how you've won 2 out of 3 analytically. You can't do it. you gotta be aware of the things you're saying with microphones in your face. And I don't think that's a good message to the team. And for all the talk he provides about not playing with force, I think when you're talking about we've won 2 out of 3 analytically, that message is not going to resonate with players either. If that's what you're saying behind the scenes to get this team rah, rah, excited to come back, it's over. I think Kenny Atkinson, in all likelihood, I'd imagine, is gone. I think we're going to see big, big questions about Donovan Mitchell. There's going to be questions asked about Evan Mobley as well. Should they go for Giannis or should they blow things up? That's a conversation more for tomorrow when we recap game four tonight, Monday. We'll obviously spend a lot more time on the Knicks and Cavs and the X's and O's side of things as well. But the two other things before my interview with Kingston Flemings, number 9, Giannis. In the rumor mill, Mark Spears from Anscape had a very interesting quote on ESPN on Monday morning where he said, I basically was told by a very good source close to the Washington situation that they're going to explore their options. And I think with some of that young talent that they have, why not write? Why not write refers to going for Giannis Antetokounmpo. He has reported that the Wizards are a team that could pursue Giannis Antetokounmpo. I don't think from my conversations, to be clear, just to make, if Wizards fans are nervous, I've been told that that would not involve the number one pick. Obviously, things could change. That's not certain. We got a long way to go until the draft, a little less than a month now. But I don't believe that this is the number one pick. I think, from my conversations, if the Wizards go for Giannis, it's more like Anthony Davis and future picks and youth. They have tradable assets, young players they could give up. They have like Trey Johnson. Maybe you would give up Alex Saar, right? Like, who was formerly a number two pick. They have young players. They have a lot of future picks. And they have a matching salary in Anthony Davis. And he doesn't even want to be there anyway. So for the Wizards, I think there could be something to this if they decide to go that route. I would anticipate that if Giannis were to say, hey, we have a deal on the table with the Wizards that we're willing to accept, he'd look at that team and see Trae Young, the number one pick, and whatever other leftover pieces they have and say, I want another guy to be there. I would imagine that that's what he would want to say. Very similar to back during the 2007 summer when the Celtics wanted to go get Kevin Garnett from the Minnesota Timberwolves. Garnett did not want to go to Boston until after the Celtics got Ray Allen. Then once they got Ray Allen, suddenly he's like, join Ray Allen and Paul Pierce? I'd like to do that. So we'll see here. I just don't think the number one pick would be on the table for the Wizards in a Giannis trade. That would shock me if that were to end up happening. But this also speaks to just why the Bucks waited. The Wizards weren't going to trade for Giannis in January or February, but more suitors appearing in the summer, that very well might be exactly what's happening here. Number 10, over on Yahoo Sports on Friday, I wrote a story about NBA draft lottery reform because this Thursday, May 28th, owners are going to vote on the 3-2-1 lottery proposal that we've talked about throughout this month. I had an update on Friday, which we'll get to what we've learned with this latest memo that the league sent out to teams. But just to recap real quick, the 3-2-1 lottery is going to have 37 lottery balls allocated to 16 teams. It's going to include the loser of the 7-8 play-in game. So we're going to 16 teams if that gets approved. We found out that the NBA is keeping the draft relegation zone in which the bottom three teams would have slightly lower odds than the next 7 teams as well. We've got clarification that picks are not going to allow to be protected for top 12, top 13, top 14, or top 15. And Adam Silver is going to have more power to punish what is perceived as tanking as well. But what we learned is very fascinating and I think reveals a major oversight by the NBA, because there was something in the original pitch back in early May when it was revealed that said the NBA wouldn't allow a team to get consecutive number one picks in 2 consecutive drafts or be in the top 5 in 3 consecutive years. What was uncertain at the time, and from my conversations with front office executives, a lot of them were wondering, does this 2-year and 3-year streak attach to the team holding the pick on lottery night, or does the streak attach to the original team whose record is attached to the pick? It's the latter. So the streak is attached to the original team, according to my league sources. And basically what this means is if Team A has Team B's pick in the 27 draft as a result of a trade, and then Team B lands the first pick, that means Team B's own pick in 2028 would not be eligible to land first, whether they keep that pick, whether they have it, whether a different team has that pick. Whereas Team A, because they got the first pick from Team B in 2027, they would still be eligible to get the first pick in 2028. So, in other words, the league is doing that because they don't want teams to have a loophole just to move their pick away in order to reset the streak. I get the reasoning for doing that. And this isn't the controversial part here. The controversial part is the fact that the NBA is starting the clock on these streaks by looking back in time, looking back retroactively. In the 2026 draft, the Wizards have the number one pick. If this is approved on Thursday, the Wizards will not be eligible to get the number one pick in 2027. For the 3-year streak, no getting a top 5 pick 3 years in a row, the league is looking back to 2025, which means in 2027, there's only one team not eligible for the top 5, and that's the Utah Jazz. One problem, the Jazz don't have their pick. They traded their pick unprotected in February to the Grizzlies for Jaren Jackson Jr. So with this ruling to look back retroactively, 2 years for the top 5 pick rule, and then 1 year for the number one pick rule, that means the Wizards aren't eligible for number one, to be clear, and the Grizzlies aren't eligible to use what was an unprotected pick in a trade just 3 months ago if it lands in the top 5. I think this is absurd. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's an absolute oversight by the NBA to do this, because since when is landing 5th considered a win. For the Jazz, 2 years ago when they landed fifth, their front office, or last year rather, when the Jazz landed fifth, they were sad and distraught and horrified. They had the best odds and they fell to fifth. They was like, oh my God, this is horrible. They ended up with Ace Bailey. It's not so bad. But they had the worst record and they ended up fifth. So you're telling me in the future, if a team has the third pick 1 year and then the fifth pick another year, they shouldn't be eligible to pick third in that third year? Just everybody I've talked to in the league, the front office executives that have reached out to me since that story published on Friday, they're like, this doesn't make any sense. So why is this happening? Why is the NBA deciding to do this? The NBA has their competition community. They have their committees that they talk to, not just the competition committee either, but these people are from other teams. There's people with their own agendas and their self-interests that are influencing this decision to go back 2 years, because if Memphis isn't eligible for a top five pick next year with the Utah pick, and if Washington isn't eligible for number one, that means everybody else's odds of moving up are better. It's just so simple. 28 other teams are rooting for this because their odds are better if the Wizards can't land number one, and if with the Jazz first, the Grizzlies can't land top five. Like, this just seems silly to me. It's such an oversight for the NBA to allow this. To me, like, I first heard this, the first person that told me this, I was like, this feels like the type of thing that your fantasy football league would argue over when you're 15 years old, not at the National Basketball Association. I couldn't believe it, but it is true. And that is what's written right now in the NBA proposal that they're going to vote on Thursday. But still, there's time to change it. I would hope they do the sensible, common sense thing here and just don't do it. And if this ruling to me is A, unfair to Memphis, I'd argue it's unfair to Washington too. They got the number one pick in a year with different rulings. And also, it's unfair to some of these other teams too. I don't like that no top five 3 years in a row, because, like, just say, for example, the Houston Rockets in 2029, they own an unprotected Suns first, right? They got that for Kevin Durant back in July of 2025, right? Let's just say the Suns miss the playoffs the next 2 years, which is possible. They might. And then in each of those 2 years, that pick ends up in the top five. You're telling me the Rockets shouldn't be eligible for a top five pick in 2029 because of a decision in May 2026 about a trade they made in July 2025? I just don't understand it. I don't think this rule makes any sense at all. I think it further overcomplicates things for the league as well, and they should just nix it. If you keep anything, keep the no number one picks in consecutive years, but get rid of this top five nonsense, in my opinion. That's what I think the league's going to do. It's the common sense thing to do. And Adam Silver in the league can't be listening to other teams with their self-interests. Silver needs to do what he knows in his heart is best and just be the leader that he can be and make the call here and just nix this from the proposal entering Thursday. All right, so tomorrow on the show, we're going to be recapping Knicks Cavaliers game four, looking ahead as well to game five between Thunder and Spurs. Boy, like, we got one crappy series in the East. It's probably going to end in a sweep. Crappy for casual fans, obviously. Awesome for Knicks fans. And then we got one unbelievable series between the Spurs and the Thunder. I'm still having a lot of fun with these. I can't wait for tonight. Is Cleveland going to have a gentleman's sweep? Are they going to win one? Or is this going to be an absolute sweep disaster for them? We'll see about that. Lots more to talk about tomorrow on the show. I get Sam Vecenie. We'll be talking NBA draft, and we'll be talking about some other stuff going on around the league as well. Up next, Kingston Fleming's potential top 10 pick in the NBA draft. I love talking to him. I think even if you are not a big NBA draft guy, you'll enjoy this conversation with Kingston Fleming's, because it's not just about him, but it's about the league as a whole and where we're going. Very much enjoyed it. Here's Kingston Fleming's. All right, welcome back. Joining me is potential top 10 pick in the 2026 NBA draft from the Houston Cougars, Kingston Flemings. Kingston, how are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
So Kingston, for people listening to this podcast, I do an NBA draft segment every week. So a lot of people do know your name, but there are some people who are just starting to tag along with the draft now. How would you describe your game to somebody who's never seen you play?
Say fast, you know, fast, get downhill, create shots for my teammates, you know, two level score. And I think just winner at the end of the day. For my name, you got to put winner behind it.
I mean, it's speed. That's like really the first thing I think of with you. I mean, obviously you're a point guard. You're going to have the ball in your hands a lot. But when I think of you, I think about sometimes when you catch the ball, like from behind the 3-point line, you kind of, as you're catching, you're attacking that closeout. And that shows off your speed a lot. Is that something you were taught at a younger age, or what's kind of the logic behind using that so as often as you do?
Definitely. I used it in high school. I used high school a little bit, but I remember going on my visit to not visit, but, talking with a coach from Arkansas, and they worked on it a lot. They called it beating someone off the catch. So I used to do that. I know I could use my speed in that way. So kind of watching them do it, I kind of just started using it a lot more in high school. And then when I got to Houston, using it a lot to catch it and just get a step on the defenders and get downhill whenever I can.
Who are some players you would compare yourself to in the NBA, either currently or historically?
I'd say Tyrese Maxey. I'd say De'Aaron Fox. I'd say definitely those two. I mean, I think obviously I want to become like a really a good point of attack defender. So like Casey Wallace, you know, really want to be able to defend. So I definitely say those three.
Who was a player you grew up idolizing?
Derrick Rose.
Oh, Derrick Rose.
That's why I wore number one. Yeah, I wore number one my whole life because of Derrick Rose. So
what appealed to you about Derrick Rose when you were a kid watching him?
I mean, obviously his speed and athleticism. I mean, that definitely correlates to me. But I was just a killer. You know, whenever he's on the court, you know, just see like fear in other teams, in the team's eyes. So whenever he's on the court, I knew he was going to go out there and hoop, and just watching him grow definitely was great.
Do you have like a – what's your favorite Derrick Rose memory from his career?
Favorite Derrick Rose memory? I don't know. Maybe the game winner they had on – the game winner he had on LeBron's team. I think maybe it was game two where he kind of was just stone-faced. He hit the game winner. He was just stone-faced. That was a pretty good memory, definitely. So –
I mean, the fact also, like, just simply he's the youngest MVP ever. Yeah, just kind of crazy. MVP
like Derrick Rose, yep.
Right? I mean, he still has that honor, especially after, you know, Wemby lost this year. SGA got the back-to-back. He had the 50-point game he had, too, later in his, what was that, like 7 years ago, 8 years ago, something that was, like that?
Timberwolves, yeah.
I mean, that was crazy. Like, the post-prime, but still being able to turn it back and have a moment like that. Just, like, a lot of... He was amazing. I'll always love Derrick Rose as a player. Hey, you mentioned Fox and Maxey, some faster guards. I feel like those are really good comparisons for you. When you're watching film, what are some of the qualities about them or other players that you try to pull from and install into your own game when it comes to projecting yourself forward in the league?
Yeah, I think Tyrese Maxey, he's a really physical driver. You know, he's not the biggest guy on the court, but, you know, uses his strength to get downhill, drive, and create angles and finish at the rim. And then definitely he's gotten to the NBA and, you know, really expanded his range, got become a better three-point shooter, more consistent, and shot him at a higher level and clip. And D. Fox, I think just however long he's been in the league, you know, just he always plays under control. You know, he's a fast, but you don't see it all game. You know, he's going to use it in short bursts. He's going to use it to the best of his ability. So definitely taking bits and pieces from both their game, just trying to use it any way I can.
Now on Synergy Sports, I just looked this up right now. Tyrese Maxey this last season took 199 shots that they label as runners, which is floaters, runners in the lane. Last season for you at Houston, 8. Not a lot of them. Is that a shot you plan on adding at some point in your career as a smaller guard? Like some of these guards you're talking about do use in their own games?
Yeah, definitely. I've been working on that a lot, you know, in college, for me, I was trying to do what I did best. So, you know, working on the floater was a little bit of that thing I did, but being comfortable in games. So definitely when I had time off now, really focusing on the floater, working on it and just becoming more consistent so I can use that in game for sure. Because there's definitely there's a level between the pull-up and between the rim, especially with the huge people they have in the NBA. You can use that floater to really just get easy points.
Now, besides the floater, just in general, if you could download a specific move from any player, what would it be?
Specific move? I mean, Donovan Mitchell has that really good overhand.
Oh,
that
yeah.
He always uses. He doesn't lose any speed going. So I definitely downloading that. That was a really good move. Let me think what else. I don't know. Donovan Mitchell's move was great. I mean, I feel like every time he uses it, it always works. Like, I've never seen it not work. Definitely Donovan Mitchell.
It's an original move, too. I don't really think I've seen too many other people, if any, ever use that move, right?
Some people use it at times, but not at the clip he does.
I think it's a good move for you, too, because, I mean, even though, like, you know, one of the critiques of you is you're not the biggest guard. You're 6'2 and a half, 6'4 wingspan, but you're an elite athlete. Mitchell, also, roughly 6'3, is an elite athlete. So that type of player construct, taking moves like that, I think would seem like a smart thing to do, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Now, I think I'm curious about, like, that move. Is that something you're actually working on? And whether you are or not, what are the things you're really working on right now, specific skills?
Yeah, I definitely work on that, get into my floater. You know, working on it today, you know, using that, get into my runner. But definitely, I mean, obviously floaters a lot. And then just consistency behind the arc, you know, working on my three ball off the dribble, because I shot a really good clip off the catch, but off the dribble, it was definitely a lower percentage. So really working on that, working on getting to the same shot pocket every single time. And then always can work on finishing at the rim. You know, the lane gets wider in the NBA, so you know, got to work on finishing and wider angles and everything like that, over length. So definitely been working on all that.
You mentioned the three-point volume off the catch. Obviously, you're more of an on-ball player, but this past season at Houston, you shot 46% on pull-up twos, 166 attempts. That's a good number. 31% on 64 pull-up threes. What specifically are you doing to extend your range off the dribble to the three-point range?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, working on just getting to the same shot pocket. You know, off the catch, I can always get it. Same shot pocket and shoot it. That's why I shoot really good off the catch. But off the dribble, especially for threes, whether it's late in the shot clock or anything, I'm kind of shooting it wherever my dribble is. And I dribble both hands a lot. So really working on getting it to the same shot pocket every single time and working on that and just staying consistent. When you consistently do the same thing, it's going to become a more consistent shot. So definitely been working on that.
Now, does that, when you talk about like getting into the same shot pocket, is that like sometimes launching from different angles and balancing yourself midair? Like, what does that mean?
Definitely. I've been working on things where like I start sideways to the rim, hop, get straight to it. I mean, because you got to be balanced as a player. You know, you're going, sometimes you're going away from the rim, you got to turn. I was good at that in the mid-range, but from three, a little different. You know, working on coming off screens, turning my body and having my chest square to the rim. So working on a lot of that just to keep my balance the right way and then just stay consistent with my jumper.
Now, I feel like, you know, the NBA nowadays, the way things have evolved, like the three-point rate continues to go up every single year. But the mid-range for star-level players, for shot creators, is still of the utmost importance. I mean, the guy who just won two-time MVP is one of the best mid-range scorers we've ever seen, and he leans on that shot in a lot of critical moments in games, and as we've seen in the playoffs as well, in end-game situations. I'm curious, like, when you talk to NBA teams and they talk to you about your scoring style, do they, like, what have the questions been like or the comments been like when it comes to your own shot distribution at the college level and how they might envision it moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, definitely talking to me about, you know, become more consistent, you know, cleaning up a little bit, you know, just everything like that. And I mean, especially when I become more consistent. And then it also depends on the team you're playing with. You know, in the NBA, people want to shoot a lot more threes, and I'm going to shoot more threes. You know, if it was like that in college, I would have shot more threes in college. But we did everything we could to win. So definitely, as I get to the next level, whatever coach needs me to do, I'm definitely going to shoot more threes, you know, with more space, everything like that, more catch and shoots. So they've definitely been talking to me about, you know, getting my three-point more consistent and then finishing at the rim. You know, beginning of the year, I was finishing at a really high clip. Later in the year, I kind of started missing those shots I was making at the beginning. So, you know, getting back to how I was at the beginning of the year. And then they said definitely developing the floater, you know, with the bigs that they're in now and knowing me, how I get to the paint so much during the game. Having that floater and having that runner is really important. So
you mentioned the at-rim finishing aspect. I mean, obviously, like, you hang in the air. You're basically levitating sometimes with your finishes. You can use either a hand. You're using English off the backboard. You have those leaning, tough offhand finishes as well around the basket. A lot of touch and craft. What did happen, in your opinion, with those percentages over the course of the season, starting high and dipping a bit?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of, you know, me not focusing as much like in games on layups, because sometimes you just lose focus on it and you got to keep with the same confidence. And then also, you know, a lot of times with the team we had, I just tried to get the ball on the rim, you know, knowing we had the rebounds like Kristen Ack, Joseph Tugler. So that shows up as like percentage, like lowering my percentage, when really sometimes I'm just trying to get on the rim because I know they're going to go get there. And that sometimes that's for our team, that was one of the best shots we could have. It's easy offense. So, you know, it's a mixture of those two, but, you know, but definitely just really focusing more on being at the rim, you know, focusing on really the rim rather than the big. You know, I didn't get my shot blocked a lot, but really focusing on that big, I think kind of made me miss more shots because I wasn't focusing on my shot and my touch.
Am I misremembering, but wasn't there like a player last year in the postseason that intentionally missed a layup? Am I just making this up, this memory, but I feel like there was something last year.
Michigan, when they played Arizona, Elliott Cadeau.
Yes.
That's what it was. Yeah, Elliott Cadeau was getting the ball in the rim, but it's really smart. I mean, when you have shot blocking on the court like Arizona has or like UConn has, really getting the ball in the rim, and that's kind of what Houston preached to me, you know, really, because I get to the rim, sometimes taking a bad shot and getting it on the rim, knowing we have Chris, we have all these guys going over to clean it up, it doesn't look good on your stats, but winning is the most important thing at the end of the day, so that's definitely what I focused on.
Are you kind of a basketball junkie? You just watching games all the time?
Yeah, I watch a lot of games for sure.
Now, what have you been thinking about the playoffs? Like, what's your one big key takeaway from the playoffs as a whole so far?
I just think at the end of the day, if you can't guard, you can't play. Because in the playoffs, they're going to attack you. They're going to seek you out the whole time. And just seeing how every single different team is. You know, the teams that are left right now, they don't have a lot of people on the court that can't really, like, can't guard. I mean, the teams that do, you see how it is. They're going to attack them over and over and over. You got teams like OKC and Spurs who don't even play a guy who can't defend. Like, every single player on the court can defend. So there's teams like that. Obviously, in the East, you know, they have they're more sided to offense. Some of those players aren't the greatest defenders. But, you know, really focusing on that. Because if you can defend, you can defend your position. Offense really is kind of the easier side. So really focusing on, you know, gaining weight, getting a little stronger, and being able to defend at a high level.
Now, you were 4 years old, I believe, when you got hit by a car chasing a ball into the street. How often do you think about that moment now? What do you remember from it? And is there any specific ways it kind of shows up in your game these days?
Yeah, I don't think about it really at all. Unless, like, I'm telling, like, a story or something, then I remember it, obviously. But, I mean, I remember a lot of it. Obviously, I remember throwing the ball across with my cousin, remember getting hit by the car. But I don't really think about it a lot. I mean, and honestly, it doesn't really affect my game in any way. I think I kind of move the same after, obviously, there's a lot of years different, a lot of years since then. So it doesn't, like, hinder me or any parts of my game. So I don't really think about it too much.
I see. I mean, I think there was a quote that you had in some story about it last year or something where, you know, maybe there's, like, a little bit of toughness, grit attached to it. Yeah. I mean, it's probably a formative thing to happen at 4 years old where you probably don't even, I would imagine, at least, I don't remember anything from when I was 4 years old. I might have gotten dropped in the head. I probably did. I don't remember anything, but it does shape you. Right? Like, it does become part of you, even if you don't remember it, right?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe it shook me into consciousness, you know, being that age. I definitely remember from then on. I remember from then on, definitely. But, you know, it just goes to show that, I mean, every day is not promised. So really just taking that every single day. I love competing at the end of the day. So whenever I'm on the court, I'm going to compete because you never know when it could be your last game. You never know what can happen. So, you know, just going competing however much I can, and that really shows in my game and who I am as a player.
Shook you into consciousness. That's a funny way to look at it.
It could have. From then on, I remember a lot of my life. Before then, I don't really remember anything. So,
like, your life, that's the way it is. Sometimes, like, your life just starts then.
Just starts. You just remember things from then on. It's really how it is. Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, clearly, if you had thrown the ball on the street then at 4 years old, you had a love for basketball when you were just a kid, right?
Honestly, it wasn't even a basketball. It was like, You know, like some of those bouncy balls that you have?
Yeah, yeah.
And what was crazy was me and my dad were talking about it. Like, before that, I didn't like playing any sports. Like, I played soccer, but I would never even really want to play. But after that, like, my dad said I wanted to play every sport. Like, I played lacrosse. I played t-ball, baseball, basketball, ran track, played football. Like, it was just crazy. It was a crazy switch from before to after. So I don't know what happened, but it, like, shook me awake, I guess.
When did the love for basketball really kind of, like, lock in?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I loved watching my brother younger. And whenever I wanted to play with him and his friend Greg, you know, I just had to figure out a way to get them the ball and just defend and be on the court. So from then on, I always just wanted to be better than him, really. So really just focusing on that, working as much as I could. And then I think really eighth grade, I really, like, thought, and I was talking with my dad, I got to focus on one sport. And I love practicing basketball, love playing basketball. So I really was like, I'm going to really focus on this and really lock down and lock in on that. So definitely around that time.
I mean, one of the things I admire about you is clearly, like, the passion for the game. I think it's apparent with you on the floor. I think it was apparent after the Illinois loss with the tears. I think I view that as a good thing. It shows a level of care. I am curious about something you said after that Illinois loss. You mentioned how it felt like the Bel Air loss in high school, and you were wondering if you did something wrong. in those games. And I'm curious, when you look back at those heartbreaks, now that you have some distance from those, what are some things you've spotlighted that you perhaps did do wrong in those games and that you feel like you're built to improve on now moving forward?
You know, I think sometimes, honestly, when you look back at any game, there's always things you're like, man, I could have done that better. But I think in those games, I think I became less, like, aggressive going towards the rim. You know, a lot of the teams I'm on, me being aggressive to the rim, it creates a lot of our offense. And knowing Illinois plays a really packed line defense, you know, I can still get downhill. So really, I think I was a little non-aggressive in those games, not getting downhill. And then it put us down early. And obviously in both those games, as a team, we didn't really shoot great. Like at Brennan, we didn't shoot great. In Houston, we didn't shoot great. But I think me getting downhill, you know, getting the ball on the rim, anything like that, definitely would have helped. So I think really staying aggressive, you know, not losing my ability to get downhill. And that creates a lot of things. Creates space for us to shoot jumpers, space for pull-ups, space for layups. So, and then obviously I'm a great passer. So definitely being more aggressive to the rim.
I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things about you when it comes to like the shot distribution numbers, right? Like people talk about you're very, at the Houston, you were very mid-range heavy. You got to the rim at a moderate amount, a very low volume for three-pointers. But I almost feel like that at-rim number with you is a little misleading because it doesn't count just paint touches and kick-out opportunities on all that. Like, you can – it's not like you're a guard who can't get to the rim. It should be like you do get to the rim. It's just when you're there, you are sometimes passing the ball out for shooters. Do you think that's a fair thing to say when I kind of analyze your game?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like if you watch my game and you really think that I can't get to the paint, I'm not really sure. I feel like that's the best thing I do. I feel like I always have 2 feet in the paint, always creating passes. But, you know, for me, especially with the teams I've been on, I've been on teams with great shooters. So really getting downhill and drawing two and kicking, you know, I think definitely getting at the rim and, you know, just being more aggressive there, you know, not like going as much as shying away from contact, but I've been going through them sometimes. I've been working on that, you know, really finishing through contact. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know if there's a stat that tracks it or something like tracks paint touches, but I feel like every single game I'm living in the paint. And the games I don't, I feel like that's when we struggle because I'm not living in the paint, not doing what I do best. So definitely that.
Well, we'll get that stat in the NBA once we have the tracking cameras on every single game. Have that in college. Sure. We have the synergy data is great, but it's more results based rather than process based, which is, I think the process stuff is what I'm so fascinated by with what the NBA data is capable of doing. Do you use data at all? Like, is that stuff interesting to you? I know some players are like, don't show me the stats. I just want to play. Like, I don't want to see the numbers. Like, what are you like when it comes to stuff like that?
Honestly, when I'm playing, I don't really use data a lot. I like looking at it after. I know synergy, like I was looking at it with my trainer and everything like that. You know, looking back how Tyrese Maxey was in college, looking back how Fox was in college. So, I mean, looking back, seeing how they played and how, you know, my game, like, regulates to theirs. But I don't use it too much, you know, in every game. Like, I'm not going to play a game and be like, oh, what were my synergy? Like, what were my stats for that game? So, definitely looking back at it and really seeing how different people are and how they play, it definitely helps mainly on defense, you know, knowing what tendencies players like to do. So, I'll definitely try to get more into that.
What weaknesses do scouts get wrong about you?
I don't know. I feel like for me, a lot of the talk has been shooting, and I feel like I'm off the dribble, definitely working on it. But I feel like if I was just a catch and shoot shooter in the corner, I feel like I would shoot like above 40% every year. Like I feel like I've never shot below. I think my last year in high school, I shot like below 36%. But outside of that, I've never shot below 36% ever. So I feel like it's just because it's more of an unorthodox shot. People kind of say that, but outside of that, I'd say scouts get wrong. I don't really know. I just feel like talking about the wingspan thing, people have been saying about the wingspan thing. I just think, I mean, if people thought I had a big wingspan watching me play before the measurements, there's obviously a reason for that. Like, obviously, I'm defending at a good level, and it makes me look longer, makes me look taller. So at the end of the day, I think measurements are one thing, but if you don't want to guard, it doesn't matter what your measurements are. You're not going to guard. So going to Houston, really focusing on that, you know, really wanting to guard. That's the beginning, I feel like, you know, really want to. So wanting to guard and just continue to get better at that. So,
I mean, on the point about the wingspan aspect, right? Like, in theory, right, there could be a guard who has the same height as you, but with a 6'8 wingspan instead. It doesn't mean that player with the 6-inch longer arm is going to be getting to the ball quicker. Right. Mm-hmm. To your point. Yeah. Right. It doesn't mean he's going to be quicker, more agile in small spaces, quicker to react it doesn't mean those things, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think me, you know, playing how I've been my whole life, I think using my speed and IQ, to you can use that on offense and defense. So I think you can't really, like, I mean, you can't measure IQ. You can't measure what someone's thinking or how they're, how, like, their speed or anything like that. So I think really that those are the things that help me a lot on defense, you know, using my natural physical gifts on defense rather than just, because, I mean, there's some people, they have a longer wingspan, but at the end of the day, they still can't guard. So really just focusing on that is my big point.
I got some random questions for you. Number one, what's your biggest motivator?
Biggest motivator? Not losing. I hate losing. I hate failing. So, you know, just pushing as much as I can and not lose or fail is definitely a big motivator.
You clearly hate losing.
Yeah, I hate it.
That's a good thing, though. All right. It's good to hate losing.
Yeah.
Number two, if you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Superpower? Probably like teleportation. Just teleport wherever you want, wherever you like think you could teleport, you just go. Definitely that.
What's your weirdest habit?
Weirdest habit? I'd say before I go to the gym, like I don't like walking around with like my socks on. So like before, if I'm walking to the gym and you see me walking to the gym, I'll never have socks on until I like get in the gym and I'm about to put my shoes on. So I guess I just won't walk around with socks on. I guess that's my weird habit.
Walk around with shoes on.
Shoes on for sure. Shoes.
Oh, but you just like, have socks on underneath?
I just like letting my feet breathe a little bit.
Okay, so, I see. Yeah. Are you the type, like, you know those, what are those shoes called? Like the shoes for the toes, you know, the toe shoes?
Oh, Crocs?
I don't know.
Oh, the toe shoes.
Yeah, the toe shoes. Are you like that type of person or something?
Okay, I've never wore those. But like, I wear like shoes or something like that. I'll just have no socks on and then I'll walk to the gym, obviously. And then I'll put my socks on. I don't know. I feel like my feet are still in clothes with socks on. I don't know.
You need some better socks.
I might.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
Biggest pet peeve? I just feel like people say you're playing a game, right? And someone gets scored on or we lose. And after the game, they're just fine. Like, say you get scored on. I want you to be like, dang, I shouldn't have got scored on. I don't want you to be like, well, I just got scored on. Let's go. Or like, we lost. And you're just like, you just don't care. I hate people that don't care about, you know, failing or losing. So I guess like what my motivator is also my biggest pet peeve when people don't have that. Like when people are just non-competitive and don't really care, that is my biggest pet peeve.
I mean, it's a good thought because I feel the same way when it comes to the care level, when it comes to competition as part of a definitely. Team situation. Like you want people to care, have buy-in, or it just kind of makes you feel like, really, I'm putting everything I have into this, and you're just like, oh, ho-hum.
I hate it.
I can't stand that either. But as someone who is a point guard, and like in your career, there's leadership potential. Clearly, you're very bright. You're vocal. You are the point guard that comes with leadership sometimes. What are the tools and what are the things to kind of work with teammates who sometimes are like that? I'm curious as a follow-up.
Yeah, I mean, I think – you know, you got to kind of know who your teammates are as people, like what gets them going, what makes them want to compete. Because obviously not everyone's super competitive. Not everyone overly cares about winning. So really just whatever you get to compete. Like, I mean, if you score this amount of points, get this amount of rebounds, maybe you'll get more money. Like thinking like giving like little incentives, things like those to really get them to compete. Because some people just compete out of just nature, like out of their nature. But some people, you know, they got to need motivation for it. So that's when knowing your teammates, you know, really learning about them and knowing who they are as people definitely comes into it.
I mean, that's smart. There are some players that will be motivated by that. You don't have to respond to this.
Exactly.
But my mind went straight to the DeAndre Ayton. My goal was to get to my second contract. That's where my mind went straight to, that classic quote. Next question. What's some music or TV show or movie that you like that would surprise some people?
Movies. I mean, I like a lot of Disney movies, Disney princess movies. I used to watch them always with my sisters. Like if you play like a Disney princess song, I'll definitely know it by heart. Cause just how many sisters I've had, how much we've watched it. Music. I mean, that's music obviously right there. Billie Eilish has some good songs. Olivia Rodrigo has some good songs. Let's see who Beyonce obviously, but that's not really understood. And then what'd you say the other one was?
TV, music, movies, TV, any of them really. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if people should be surprised. I like anime, watching anime. Mm-hmm. That's definitely become more mainstream now, but I like watching a bunch of those. But definitely like Disney movies, Disney princess movies, you know, I'm on all that. So,
what's your favorite anime?
Definitely probably Attack on Titan.
Okay.
Attack on Titan.
How about, yeah. Do you ever watch the show Death Note? You ever watch that?
I watch Death Note. Yeah, Death Note's good.
That's an all-time classic, good. Right?
Definitely. Death Note, Dragon Ball Z, all that. I'm tapped in.
Yeah. I'm 35 now. I don't know when I watched Death Note. I was probably like 17 or something like that when I watched Death Note. It's been a long time, but I always love the music in Death Note. Sometimes I still listen to it.
The music's a banger for sure.
It's just such a good soundtrack. What was it, Light or L or one of the characters?
L and Light, yeah.
Just so many good songs on the Death Note soundtrack. What do you do besides basketball? You kind of already answered a little bit of that with TV and all that, but what else do you do besides basketball?
I mean, definitely hanging out with family and friends, and honestly, anything I want to do, you know, whether it's pickleball, you know, escape rooms, or just, you know, literally anything. I go out to eat, like anything they want to do, bowling. I like doing all these things. You know, I'm obviously a competitive guy, but just hanging out with people, definitely people that I love and I've grown up with, definitely those.
You said escape rooms. I did one of those before. Those are fun. Talk about teamwork, right?
They're definitely fun. Yeah, there was a bunch in Houston. So I used to always do them with some of my teammates, and those are definitely fun for sure.
Heard you're a Seahawks fan. You're like a big NFL fan?
Mm-hmm, I am. NFL and NBA, I know a lot about both. So I feel like I can argue about both or talk about both either. I've been a Seahawks fan probably since Legion of Boom. Wow. So it was great seeing the Patriots lose this year. Cause I remember the only game I've ever cried at as a kid was when we threw on the 1 yard line. That was the only game I've ever cried at. And honestly, it's unpopular opinion, but I don't think it was that bad of a play.
Really? You don't think that was bad of a play?
If you think about it like this, the clock was running, right? If you throw it in the ball, like they don't catch it, clock stops, and you still have three more plays and you have all time. If you run it and get stopped, we had no timeouts or maybe one timeout, clock would have ran and it was running our pace. We would have had to call a bad play. Obviously, Malcolm Butler made a great play. And hindsight's key. It looks great out in hindsight. But in the moment, obviously, we have Marshawn Lynch in the back. But I think either one of the decisions would have been good. So
you don't know this about me, but I was very blessed to grow up a Patriots fan.
I hate the Patriots.
I don't blame you. I would hate the Patriots too if I grew up a fan of any other team.
I can respect Tom Brady because he's a winner. He's definitely the GOAT. But I mean,
congratulations to your Seahawks winning this year's Super Bowl. Of course, getting a little bit of
seeing us beat them.
I mean, what year were you born?
07.
07. So, like you, this is one thing you can't remember is this 18-1 Super Bowl loss, Patriots Giants. That's the one time I cried when I was on the floor crying when the Patriots lost that game. I don't know if you ever watched the highlights.
Eli Manning be killing the Patriots.
I know. Two Super Bowls. I mean, how does Eli Manning? Patriots had no issues with Peyton for years, but with Eli.
Eli, we all draw the line. So.
I know. Yeah, I don't know if you ever watched the highlights from that game, but talk about heartbreak. Helmet catch.
That was a helmet catch. I remember that was the helmet catch.
Asante Samuel dropped an interception on the sideline that would have sealed the game. Enough about me and my heartbreak. last question for you, Herr Kingston. What do you love most about basketball?
I think being able to just – the places it takes you, obviously, and just being able to learn about new people and, you know, me competing at the end of the day. I mean, the amount of people I've met through basketball, you know, friends and people and family I'll – being my rest of my life, you know, just being in that, and it really teaches you a lot of lessons, you know, really going out there, compete, and just, you know, just learning my teammates, you know, wherever I play, you know, learning the things they're going through, learning the things that they really enjoy. So definitely that, you know, and at the end of the day, I mean, I'm a competitor, so I love competing.
Kingston, thank you so much for joining me, man, and good luck and enjoy this whole process, man. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, for sure.
Big thank you to Kingston Flemings for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back again tomorrow with Sam Vecini. We'll be talking about everything going on around the NBA and the NBA draft as well. Thanks to Emmy and the team for producing today's episode. Talk to you on Tuesday.